This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 121. Hey, everyone, and welcome to the best of 2024 episode on the Future of HR Podcast. Before I get to who you can expect to learn from in this best of episode, I want to take a moment to highlight what an incredible year 2024 was for the podcast and for me personally. We had over 100,000 downloads for the second year in a row, which is truly amazing. And we continue to get some of the top CHROs and thought leaders as guests. And I'm very grateful for all the guests for sharing their insights with us and being part of the podcast. And what I'm most proud about is that I continue to get emails from you that say the podcast is helping you have more impact in your role and accelerate your career. Please keep those emails coming. I'd love to hear from you. 2024 was also an incredible year for me personally. It was the year that I decided to go all in on my mission to help next-gen HR leaders develop the skills, mindset, and tools they need to become strategic business leaders. To bring my mission to life, I created and launched the Next-Gen HR Accelerator Program, which has been a big success and will have our third sold-out cohort starting January 21st. Next, I wanted to give next-gen HR leaders like you a chance to learn directly from the top thought leaders in our field. So I launched Elevate by Future of HR, which was a three-week virtual development program featuring 21 of the top minds in our field. This was an amazing experience, and I'm so excited to make Elevate even better in 2025. I also had the incredible honor of being a speaker at 8 world-class HR functions, internal HR conferences. This has probably been one of the biggest highlights of my year. But last, but definitely not least, I've had the opportunity to partner with several CHROs and their organizations to elevate their HR functions and talent practices. By all measures, 2024 has been an amazing year, and I am so grateful for you, for listening to the podcast, for sharing the podcast with your friends and colleagues, for supporting my mission, and for the relationships that have resulted from the podcast. So thank you. I'm excited to build on this momentum and have even more impact in 2025. With that, let's get to the best of 2024 episode. Now, as you can imagine, selecting the best episodes and moments was almost next to impossible. We had so many amazing guests, and to that end, I had to make some tough judgment calls. I did look at total downloads, reflected on the episodes, especially the ones I received lots of emails or comments on LinkedIn. And while I tried to be objective, I also wanted to make sure this episode represented the amazing mix of talent and thought leadership we've had on the podcast in 2024. This was not an easy task. So who can you expect to hear from today? Rhonda Morris, Jeffrey Pfeffer, Carrie Perino, Kevin Wilde, Sean Mayo, Dave Ulrich, Bob Eichinger, Alan Church, Kelly Monahan, Lieber Clemens, Lucian Alzari, Kevin Cox, Anthony Nyberg, Amy Cates, Jordana Kamarud, Ginger King, Stephanie Lilac, Tim Richmond, and Prasad Sethi. I know you're going to love this episode. I had a lot of fun putting it together. First up is the amazing Rhonda Morris, who recently announced her retirement as Chevron CHRO, and she's one of the best and most beloved HR leaders in the business. In episode number 70, Taking Calculated Risks, Rhonda shares why she believes the best HR leaders practice what she calls other thinking in everything they do. You practice something called other thinking. Tell us more about what this means and why it's so helpful to you.
Other thinking is not original thought on my part. I learned this from one of our leaders who sadly passed away earlier this year, years ago. So my husband worked for Chevron for a long time up until I got this job. And so we got married in our 30s. By the time we got married, we had a lot of friends with a lot of small kids. We sat down and made a list, and a whole bunch of our friends, you know, had married, we'd been to a lot of weddings. We made a list of everything we didn't like about every wedding we had ever gone to. And one of them was not having children at your wedding. And so we had 200 people at our wedding. 40 of them were under 12 years old. So I was talking to my friend Dave about this, and we rented a room just for the kids. And they had their auction. They had a balloon artist. They had a magician. They had toys to play. We hired like 3 or 4 babysitters. And they had a little name tag like that would say, I'm Erica Morris, daughter of Rhonda and Jack, who are at table 12. So if they wanted to go see their parent, they could go into the room where our reception was, or the parent could come in and see them. But what we didn't want our friends not to come to our wedding because they were afraid of their kids making noise or being disruptive. We wanted the kids to have fun. We wanted their parents to have fun. So my friend Dave looked at me and he said, that is an example of other thinking, of thinking about what is the experience of the other person going to be like. I think that is transferable to pretty much anything we do. I talked earlier about the benefit of having been a customer of HR and having now the perspective of what is the impact of what we're doing on any business leader or quote customer of our function. I also firmly believe that the onus and burden of understanding the effectiveness of one's communication is on the person delivering the message, because you have to test for understanding. And I have, especially now, because people are so distracted, I always ask, is what I'm saying clear? And that gives someone the opportunity to say, no, I don't understand what you're talking about. Because in a lot of cases, nobody's going to raise their hand and go, I have no idea what you're talking about. But if you ask them, you open the door for them to do that. And sometimes I will ask people to repeat back what I said just to make sure what I said was heard correctly. In many cases, you'd be surprised if you just simply ask someone to repeat it back, what went through their brain and what comes out is not what you meant. So it creates an opportunity to make sure that you have alignment on the words you used, what you said, what they heard. Because if those things are misaligned, that's how people get a bit crosswise sometimes, or it could lead to further misunderstanding. So I try to do that more and more frequently, and not in a way that makes someone think that I don't think they're smart and they don't understand. It's just like, are we on the same page?
Next in episode 72, The 7 Rules of Power, Stanford professor Jeffrey Pfeffer stopped by to share why we are often our biggest barrier to having more influence in organizations and in life. More importantly, he talks about why HR leaders need to lean into our power and how to get more power. Jeffrey, you said the single biggest barrier to having power is ourselves. And the first rule of power is to get out of our own way. Why is that, and what can we do about this?
I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with the idea of imposter syndrome. People do not think they deserve to be in the positions that they're in. I think this affects people differentially by gender, whatever. There's kind of a joke, except it's not really a joke, because I think that there's a reality to it. The many women, if they're offered a promotion, will think whether or not they're qualified. And the men will think, why didn't I get the promotion months ago or years ago? We carry around in our heads ideas that we don't deserve where we are, or we're not qualified for certain jobs. One of my good friends is Deborah Liu, who was a senior executive in Facebook. She's now CEO of Ancestry.com, raised as an Asian American woman in the South. She now, of course, lives in Silicon Valley. She was very modest and very self-effacing. She had to learn from her executive coach to get over that, to take credit for what she and her team was doing in Facebook. And she tells an interesting story. She, by the way, wrote a fabulous book, which is a book about telling women to get out of their own way, which is an interesting idea. She ran a project at Facebook that was accounted for about 15% of the company's revenue, but she never really promulgated or promoted that project. Not only didn't she get credit for leading that project, but the team didn't get credit. And all the members of her team therefore left the organization. For the next time she ran a similarly important project, she was much more willing to take credit for both herself and her team, to say, look at what we've done, and not expect people to necessarily recognize it without her engaging in a certain amount of self-promotion. And I can recall when she would come to my class, we would often have lunch after she came to my class and appeared on a panel with other alums from Stanford. And I would say to her, Deborah, when are you going to be a CEO? And she would say, I'm not sure I'm ready. Then, of course, her executive coach would say the same thing. And finally, she, I guess, decided that she was ready. By the way, the title of her book is Take Back Your Power, which is completely consistent with rule one, to get out of your own way. Take back your power. Don't give it away. I'm thrilled that she has now leaned into her power. And before she took her job, maybe 2 or 3 years before, because she's come now for 8 or 9 or 10 years, I said to her, Deborah, you, of course, are the same person. But as I have watched you show up in this class over the years, you have become more assertive. You speak with more power. Your voice is different. The way you hold yourself is different. You act and behave with a greater level of confidence. I can see your evolution. She comes once a year, from year to year to year. We talked about that. She said, when I come to your class to speak, I know I have to put on my A game, and I know I have to be better this year than the year before. So actually coming to my class turned out to be a developmental experience. But I think that's an example of how people get in their own way. I'm not deserving of this, not as good as I am. This is a woman who, by the way, has patents. I think we are our biggest barrier. Number one, because we don't think of ourselves as the powerful, successful, accomplished people that we often are. And number two, many of us are not willing to do what is necessary to win in the games of organizations. One of the readings which I assigned to my class is a reading by Sam Borden, which talks about U.S. men's soccer and the wonderful idea that the greatest soccer players are great at drawing fouls. So Cristiano Ronaldo, if you see him play soccer, somebody barely bumps into him and he runs, rolls over on the ground and whatever and tries to draw a foul. And the U.S. men's soccer team, of course, won't do that because it's beneath them. And of course, therefore, they suffer as a consequence. And so I see many people say, I am not willing to network, or I'm not willing to self-promote, or I'm not willing to watch Amy Cuddy's YouTube video on power posing and worry about my body language. People ought to recognize me for the great work that I do. They opt out of the game. And if you opt out of the game, your odds of winning are zero.
Next up is Carrie Pereno, Chief People Officer at Verily. And she gives us a masterclass on mentoring and sponsorship in episode 73. In this clip, you'll hear Carrie talk about why you can ask for a mentor, but you must earn a sponsor. And of course, how to do it.
I'm also curious, Carrie, from your perspective, there's a lot of talk about sponsorship, mentorship. What's the difference between the two?
Great question. And there's a clear answer. You can ask for a mentor, but you must earn a sponsor. At the basic level, that is the answer. I have folks in the organization today who talk about wanting that person who can sort of be a guide, a Sherpa to them as they go through their career. And I can pair them with a mentor. I can coach them on how to ask a mentor to be a mentor to them or a person to be a mentor to them. But I cannot ask someone to be your sponsor. You actually have to earn that. And that means they need to see your work. So visibility is hugely important as you are working to earn that advocacy that can blossom into sponsorship. It starts with the table stakes are certainly good work, right? You must be doing good work. And that's the first part of it. Then there's consistency over time, continuing to see you doing good work, showing up in meaningful ways, and then taking those opportunities, finding the stage where your work can shine. And then sponsors will notice you. People will notice you. And they could start out as a mentor, but sponsorship is something they are freely giving you, not something you are asking for.
In episode 75, Coachability, the Leadership Superpower, Kevin Wilde, author of Coachability, shares his insights and research on what makes a leader coachable and what he calls the learning zone.
And you talked about this idea of seeking feedback. So does that make you a coachable leader? Or what does that mean to be a coachable leader?
Let me start with the definition that I came up with. And essentially, I started by interviewing 50 executive coaches. When you see highly coachable clients, what do you see? What do you see when it's missing? Then did the academic literature on everything from emotional intelligence to seek feedback orientation. Essentially, what I came up with was three things. Number one, the highly coachable leaders had a mindset. And the mindset was, I'm not done. I want to keep learning. I'm an unfinished product and I'm curious. So that was kind of the mindset that, if you will, that growth mindset that drove coachability. And then there were four practices. And as I started studying highly coachable leaders, their differences, they had habits that worked for them in four areas. And one was they found a way to seek. They found a way to investigate, hey, how am I doing? How am I coming across? What should I be paying attention to that I'm not? There's a variety of techniques that are in the book that they started using. So there was seek, and then it was, well, when feedback shows up, how do you act? Let's face it, feedback is not a gift. It is hard. It is emotional. And these highly coachable leaders learned how to take it and learned how to turn it into a positive experience. The third thing is they would then reflect. They took the time to think about it more than we usually do. And if it was important, they then acted. So that was kind of the five-part model, that you had a mindset, I want to get better, I should be open, and then four specific practices of seeking, responding well, reflecting, and acting. And happy to talk about any of those. The one thing, JP, I want to get into is, before you get into the techniques, this notion about what's the value, and you know, why would you value being highly coachable? Again, there's a big upside on what I found is highly coachable leaders, the academic literature would show higher levels of performance, higher levels of employee engagement, higher promotability scores. I saw one study that angel investors are more than willing to invest in highly coachable entrepreneur startups. Statistically, there are stats that show that if you are seen as a highly coachable salesperson, you're more than your peers to achieve your sales goal, and on and on and on. But it's an underserved topic. We rush into the lesson, we rush into development without thinking about how do we help leaders own their coachability? And it starts with what I call the learning zone. That's a study we did. We looked at 200 leaders where we had their judgment of how coachable they were seen by others. And then we had a personality assessment of their confidence. And it wasn't linear. It was fascinating. It was actually what's called curvilinear, low confidence, low coachability, high confidence, low coachability. And the sweet spot was the middle. And that's what I call a learning zone. And back to these practices of seek, respond, reflect, and act, that helped leaders get into their learning zone and not drift into what I call the I can't or the I don't care zone.
In episode 91, Future of Work Key Trends, Kelly Monahan joins the podcast to share her insights and research on where she sees the future of work heading, including the key demographic trends and growing disparity between supply and demand for certain skills. Let's go back to, you mentioned, you know, there's more demand for jobs, right, than the supply. And that, you know, we have more, workers really have more power than they have, but it doesn't feel like that. You know, we see people who are obviously struggling or looking for roles. What are some of the trends that are kind of, I guess, give you confidence to say that there is less supply, but more demand for workers and that will continue in the future?
Yeah. There are a couple of different dynamics and nuances to unpack here. For the first time, at least in our modern work history, we have more people exiting and retiring the workforce than we do coming in. And so that alone is creating, you know, I think some academics have called it a silver tsunami, where we just have people who are exiting at almost 5-to-1 the ratio in industries like manufacturing and construction as perfect examples. And so what that alone is creating is our labor supply imbalance simply because you don't have enough people entering at fast enough rates. And I know it's keeping a lot of HR leaders up at night within that realm is you can't upskill. Who's going to be training the people if they're leaving faster than those who are entering in? And how do you have that knowledge transfer occur in a way where you have potentially so much legacy knowledge being lost within certain industries? The second thing is what we see is Gen Z is actually delaying some of their entry into the workforce and focusing on continuing education and or AI skills training. We're seeing as a reason for some of their delay. And so again, we've seen this is a trend that the millennials had as well, but a little bit of a delay of entry into the workforce and starting at an older age. And then finally, I think what we've seen with AI, which we've seen with any other technology, is a skills bias technology change, meaning there are going to be a lot of new jobs that are being created because of AI, but the workforce today often doesn't have the skill set that's needed. And so there's a bit of an imbalance of what companies are needing, where we're seeing the openings, and then what skill sets workers currently have. And then the last thing, and I don't have a good answer for this trend, to be fully honest with you, but like the jobs report just came out today. And what we saw is a lot of growth in government, retail, healthcare, really social services. We as a society, I think, have tend to undervalued and really not, their pay wages aren't the same there, but that is where a lot of the demand still is within our society and where the work needs to get done. And so how do we make those jobs more appealing? How do we maybe even balance some of the pay rates that's happening there? Because that is where a lot of the demand is today.
Next up is the most downloaded episode of the year, featuring three talent legends, Dave Ulrich, Bob Eichinger, and Alan Church. In episode 90, The Science of Talent Management, we covered a lot of ground on talent, how to define and identify potential, and much, much more. But in this clip, I got the chance to ask Dave and Bob for their thoughts on the skills-based movement.
To Bob, I've got a question for you, Bob. You are known really probably best for starting the competency movement with Michael Lombardo, creating the Lominger competency model, which is the gold standard, if not almost every competency model has been built on. And so I've got to ask you, what do you think about skills and skills-based organizations versus competencies? What's the real on this?
Well, competencies are made up of what we call KSAs. There's a knowledge component, a skills component, and an attribute component. So the skills movement is fine. Those that are moving to the skills marketplace are missing the attribute piece primarily. So there's nothing wrong with skill. Skills are wonderful. Skills are incompetencies. But you got to be careful to make sure the knowledge and wisdom component is in it and the attribute, personality, style, values. It's an incomplete method of talent management.
Interesting, because I always feel like it's old wine and new bottle. In thinking about we're rebranding competencies now as skills and people want to become skills-based organizations, but you're saying really we are missing the knowledge and the attributes piece.
Well, especially if you look at derailment, 96% of derailment comes from non-skill issues, primarily attributes, EQ and interpersonal transactional style. So if you're doing just skills movement, you're going to miss derailment.
That's a really great point and statistic. Dave, your perspective on skills and competencies and what we may or may not be getting right around this?
Bob is the expert, and I'll defer to Bob's data, but I'll have one thought. I think our field has a habit of recycling, not respiraling. Recycling means you take something old, you put a new, you called it old wine in new bottles, and we should cycle forward. My sense is the forward cycle is not just knowledge, skills, and abilities. Attributes. I'm sorry, Bob. Attributes. I got it wrong. Knowledge, skills, and attributes that will help us be successful in the marketplace. The old competence model was, here's 30 people who did well, here's 30 people who were average, what are their differences? I'd rather say, where is our business going with our customers, our investors, our markets? What set of knowledge, what set of skills, what set of attributes will help us get to the future? That's spiraling forward, not recycling. I see right now, most of the skills movement that I see is simply recycling in not a very innovative way.
In episode 86, Navigating the Future of DEI and HR, the innovative and business-focused Libra Clemens stops by to share why she believes chief diversity officers make great chief people officers, and we discuss the current different approaches companies are taking to DEI in the current environment.
In the marketplace, some companies are eliminating these roles, some are combining them with HR. What are you seeing there? Are you seeing that kind of they're saying, well, we're going to give this to HR partners now. We're still going to have some commitment. We're just not going to have a chief diversity officer. What are you hearing in that area?
I think it's a combination of things. So some of it is a headcount conversation. It's like, well, we're going to eliminate this head of diversity. We don't need that person. It is a headcount. As companies are actually eliminating roles in general, that's a conversation that people have, and they make a decision whether or not they're going to eliminate that headcount. So it becomes a headcount conversation. Then I do think that some of the very basic understanding of what DEI is, which typically does not always mean that it's DEI. So ERGs, for example, I'm seeing a lot of companies say, hey, we're going to eliminate the DEI person, but we're going to give all the work to ERGs, the employee resource groups. Employee resource groups do not equal DEI. They're a component of it, but that's not what this is. So you see a lot of companies making those decisions because they want to keep something, but not really understanding what diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, whatever you want to call it, it's all the same. Whatever that is, they don't fully understand that it is promoting equity at all costs, but also dismantling systems that actually have created inequity. And I think that you need someone who has been in the space that understands all components of HR systems, that has a voice, that understands business strategy, that understands decision-making, so that decisions that are being made are in favor of all people and all communities and not just one over the other. ERGs are not in a place to do that. So we're seeing a lot of decisions being made, like, let's eliminate the headcount. Let's shove everything over to the ERGs, which is completely unfair on so many levels. One, they're not equipped to do it. Two, they don't have the skill set. And three, that's not their jobs. You end up paying the ERGs, which I think is also kind of weird because they have a job. So it's just a really, really strange distribution of roles and of work. I've seen people, to your point earlier, offer some of the work to the HR business partners. Not here to pass judgment, but I will say, not all HR business partners are created equally, nor do they have the full understanding or awareness of the breadth of the work that needs, that you will need in order to drive DEI, which is part of the problems that a lot of DEI people have, especially if they are reporting to a chief people officer or sitting within HR. This assumption that all HR people really understand or behind DEI is kind of false too. Some do, some don't. So I think you're seeing a bit of that. So it gets lost in the shuffle. I see people just getting rid of it altogether. Just like, that's not for us. We can't do it. Apologies. And then there are people that are unapologetic about it. You're always going to have that, those companies that are like, this is who we are. This is basically our brand. This is what our company is built on. So we will forever be committed to this work. It falls into different buckets, but what I am seeing more of is the elimination of certain roles, having someone there without resources, without headcount, which to me, net-net is the same thing as eliminating the role.
Next up is my friend, Sean Mayo, Chief People Officer of Arizona Cardinals. And in episode 79, Sean shares what it's like to be a Chief People Officer in the NFL and why there is no offseason for his HR team.
We talked about this in the past, Sean, because we've gotten to know each other a little bit. Only one team can win the Super Bowl, right? We all want our team to win the Super Bowl, but only one team can really win. But what I was impressed with is that the Cardinals ownership and you really focus on instilling a championship culture on and off the field, right? It's not just all the 11 guys on the field plus, right? It's everyone who's helping incorporate that you want to have a championship culture. So talk more about what does this look like and what you guys are trying to instill.
Yeah, for us, I think it's a couple of different things. Yes, you're right. Only one team can win a Super Bowl. That's the ultimate goal, I think, every year. But we recognize that only one team can do so. And talked about this industry versus others. One of the things that I didn't really think about coming into this industry is all of the different business elements that are tied to a team, right? We see the teams on the field every Sunday or whatever day they're playing. And you think about the 53-man roster. There's just a whole lot of other things that are happening behind the scenes. Success isn't just dictated by what's on the field. I like to think of the business in two different aspects. You've got our football operations, which, yes, success is defined by wins and losses. But then you also have our business operations. And like most organizations and business entities, we have business goals. We can have winning seasons on the business side while maybe not finding as much success as we would like on the football side. In the perfect world, yes, you're successful on both sides of the business, but there's business behind football is what I would say. And that helps us to think about being champions. And we think about that really in three different aspects, which is on the field, in the community, as well as a business operations unit.
That's a great point to think about, obviously, the football team and then you got the operations, business operations side, all going for a Super Bowl. Because when you think about companies, we set our goals, but most companies don't hit their Super Bowl every year either, right?
Yeah.
We might miss our goals. Some goals we exceed, some we miss, right? So it's interesting to your point, like, you know, the game's never over. When you think about that business operations side, the season doesn't really end for you guys to keep things moving, right? You're still hiring, retaining, yeah, engaging, right? And I know we think about the season in football, it's like, oh, it's over, and then you start off season. It's just not that clean when you think about HR, the business side of it. So it's interesting.
It's not. First few years I worked here, folks would ask me, oh, what are you doing off season? I would have to say, like, hey, actually, believe it or not, the off season is like actually my on season. Like when you think about all the different things to get done and get ready for the actual season, that's typically happening when the team's not playing. And while the attention is on really the football side of the business during the season, immediately after, I would tell you that the switch flips and it's really focused on the business side and all the different things that we're thinking about and doing to make our business better for the next season starts to happen in the off season. I'm traditionally extremely busy in the off season, and actually in the season, I can actually maybe sit back some and watch what's happening on the field versus this misperception that the off season, we're just all off and get to relax until August rolls around. So there's a lot of things happening, I'd say, in the business of football.
In episode 102, What Works Organizational Design, renowned expert on organizational design, Amy Cates, shares why organizational design is much more than org charts and who reports to whom. If you ever wanted to learn about organizational design, be sure to check out this episode.
And when we talk about applying organizational design, Amy, a lot of leaders, when they hear that term, they're like, oh, sure, org charts and who reports to who, but we know there's a lot more to organizational design than just boxes on an org chart. How do you explain and define organizational design to leaders?
Yeah, it's a great question. For sure, the org chart is an outcome. We want to know, who do we report to? But it's not a design tool. When we think about org design, what are we designing? We're designing human behavior at scale. And again, the best way that I've ever seen to think about shaping behavior at scale is Jay Galbraith's STAR model, in which you start with strategy. What kind of organization do we want to build? What culture do we need? How are we going to compete and win? What choices have we made about how we're going to grow and where we're going to play? Then the next set questions is, what capabilities do we need? What new organizational muscles do we want to build? And Jay's great insight was, first, depending on the strategy, that will shape the organization. There's no one best way to organize. And number two is that a leader has four levers to pull. One is structure, which is really about power, the architecture, roles and leaders and who sits around the table to make decisions. The second are processes. How do we design conversation and decisions and move information across the organization? The third is metrics and reward. How do we motivate and inspire people and align what they do and where they spend their time when they wake up in the morning, come to work, with the mission of the organization? And then finally, our people practices, which are all the choices we make around, who do we hire? Do we grow or do we buy talent? How do we compensate? How do we learn, treat learning and development, and think about the employee life cycle? Those four levers create a system that builds capabilities, that create the culture that we want, the performance that we want, and allows us to not only deliver on the business strategy, but what's really important to me is to make a great place to work. We spend so much time at work that I feel that organization design is not just a technical task to make an efficient and effective organization and a business, but actually to create an environment where people can come and really feel that they can contribute and bring their talent.
Next up, episode 100, What Works CEO Succession, with Kevin Cox, former CHRO for GE and Amex, and Anthony Nyberg, who runs University of South Carolina Center for Executive Succession. In this clip, Kevin shares what really works and matters when it comes to CEO and executive succession. And while he's talking about the C-suite roles, I think his insights can apply to almost any critical role or leadership role in an organization.
Let's talk about executive succession. We all know it's critical, yet a lot of organizations struggle to do this pretty well. I mean, if we're really honest with ourselves, we're pretty poor at succession at all levels, but even executive, maybe just as bad, frankly. Kevin, what do you think about, what are some of the barriers to effective executive succession? And then on the flip side, what does good or effective C-suite succession look like?
This is another one of those similar to the question you asked about culture. I think in the earlier parts of my career, I thought that succession was all about assessment and sort of detective work to see whether the person had the right stuff or not. And I put kind of most, if not all, of my energy into that. And as I got deeper into this and did more of it, I came to understand that the harder part of that, the harder part than finding who has the right stuff, is actually identifying what it is you're looking for in the first place. And I would tell you the tendency the starting point for most succession work that I've been party to, whether it's by boards of directors or incumbent CEOs or just about anyone, they skip that step or they want to gloss over or they want to make it very generic. In the best successions that I have been party to, there's actually been a big Trojan horse where, lo and behold, strategy is really what's being discussed. Do we want a CEO who is a big brand builder? If so, let's go look there. Do we want a CEO who's somebody who comes out of a highly regulated industry? If so, let's go look there. Do we want somebody who is a general manager at scale and has run multi-billion dollar companies? If so, let's go look there. Those are all three legitimate ways to think about it. They would yield very different candidates. So I tend to ask CHROs and CEOs and boards to pump the brakes on, let's build a list of who might be able to do that. And let's really sweat the details about what are we looking for, and not a laundry list, but what are the difference makers? What are the attributes? What are the qualities that we really want to find? And I would just contend that the easier part is in the matching exercise. Once you figure that out and you get alignment around it, that's going to hold, then you can go out and find internal or external candidates that are best fit.
In episode 105, Jordana Kummerud, CHRO at Corning, joins the podcast and gives advice to HR leaders on how to build and ask for what she calls an all-access pass. This episode is a must-listen for all HR business partners, as it's full of great advice to build and deepen relationship with your stakeholders.
And really, I think in what I've seen in the podcast is that, in experience, frankly, CEO and CHRO relationships are so important and so critical to delivering the value you need. And so I'd love to hear more about what you believe a great CEO and CHRO relationship looks like. And specifically, let's talk about what CEOs should expect from CHROs and what CHROs should expect from CEOs.
Yeah. Well, I think all great partnerships are based on aligned purpose, mutual trust, and healthy candor. And I think that's true CEO, CHRO, and any other relationship you have in your life. But particularly with this relationship, I think it helps if you like each other too, as humans. So those are hallmarks to me. But I think CEOs should expect that CHROs be fully versed in the business and be considering the same vantage point they are, thinking about the same stakeholders they are, board, leadership, employees, customers, communities. And from that vantage point of consideration, the CEO should expect that the CHRO is going to bring, through their lens of their expertise on people, recommendations to achieve the aligned purpose of the org. So the CEO should really be expecting that and holding their CHRO accountable to do that. And I think CHROs should expect and request the all-access pass, which is, I need to be able to have any discussion with you, need to be able to bring any observation, and I need to be involved in those things that I believe are vital for me to be involved in so that I can have the organization, HR function, support this organization's success. This takes some time. As I said, sometimes CEOs and leadership teams are not raised to think of the CHRO in that context, and or sometimes it's just not the first instinct. Why would the people person be in this meeting? But if you have, in the interview process and in the onboarding process and in an ongoing basis, those conversations with your CEO about, this is why I need to be part of that decision, and accept the fact that sometimes they might accidentally miss you because of that. Over time, you will get in your rhythm of what you need to be in and what don't need to be in that moment. And over time, when you start to bring that all access pass request and you start to bring the observations, even the ones that are uncomfortable, and you work through that together, it becomes a really beautiful place where it's one of the most powerful unlocks for an organization when the CEO and the CHRO are working in that kind of trust, candor, all access pass discussion type basis.
Next up is episode 94, Winning with Talent, with Lucy and Alzari, CHRO Prudential.
And in this clip, Lucian explains the fundamental role of HR in a way that is simple, straightforward, and frankly brilliant. This was a great episode and one to check out if you missed.
Another thing I really admire about your career is that you are someone who I think has just been focused on what you call the fundamental truths of HR and remain constant. There is a lot of noise in our HR systems and in the marketplace, right? A lot of bright, shiny objects in HR, but yet you have really stayed true to the fundamental truths throughout your career. And I wonder if you could tell us more about what those fundamental truths are to you and how you think about that.
I really think it comes back to one fundamental truth, which is what's our role? Our role is not to do great HR work or come up with the next fad, any of that. Our role is to help our businesses win. If that's our true north and we do that knowing that if we treat people properly, they deliver great performance. When they deliver great performance, our businesses win. That's why what we do is very, very noble work, because it really does bring together all of our values about how people should be treated with all of the outcomes that we need to deliver as business leaders. But if you were to sample a group of CEOs and say, what made the difference for them between the best CHROs that they work with and the rest, I'd pretty much guarantee you they would talk about business leadership. This person saw themselves as a business leader first, who happened to have accountability for talent and culture and capabilities, not an HR person who was just doing good generic HR work. That to me is like the fundamental truth. And so I will quite often have these kind of existential debates with people about deep in your soul, like, who are you? When I ask you that question, is your answer, and you don't need to share it with anybody, but is your answer to yourself, I'm an HR person. I love to do HR work. I really enjoy doing HR practices. Or do you self-identify as, I'm a business leader. I happen to have accountability for talent and capabilities, but my fundamental drive is, how do I help this company win?
In episode 108, The Power of Being Bold, I had the pleasure of speaking with Ginger King, CHRO at Kohler. And she is one of the most business-focused and approachable leaders I've ever met. And here I ask for her wisdom and advice on how next-gen HR leaders can learn the business and develop their business acumen.
And one of the things I am super passionate about for next-gen HR leaders is to learn the business, is to develop that business acumen. And I think we don't do enough, frankly, to help people figure this out. We talk about it a lot, but there's not a lot of pathways to that. But what recommendations and advice would you give to a next-gen HR leader who's trying to improve their business acumen and maybe possibly own a P&L one day?
I think it starts with whatever role you are in, really understanding the business that you are working in, how what you do is impacting the strategy, and how you add value. Not waiting for somebody to give you that context or wondering, having that natural curiosity to figure it out. There's lots of ideas I would have as to how best to do this. It all comes back to this willingness to learn and get involved. Never turn down the opportunity to go to a meeting and be a part of various cadences that exist in the business to make decisions. Go listen, learn. And I think what's really important is engaging in topics outside of just the HR topics on the agenda. Too often I will see HR leaders almost disengage during portions of the discussion that are really important until it's almost their turn. I think that's the difference between setting yourself up as this leader versus a functional leader. Make friends with your finance partners. That is really important to understand the P&L, to understand how, as business decisions are made, they impact the various financial statements. And partnering with the right finance leader, you'd be amazed, just as we are, if somebody were to come in and sit down with us and want to learn about what we do. They're very eager to share and to teach. So finding that right finance partner. I would say building a network cross-functionally as well, making sure that you're not surrounding yourself only with HR people, but that you're really building relationships outside of the function. They come in hand so frequently when you have questions and when you need a deeper understanding of things. And spending time with people that do other things, you naturally learn about what they're doing as well. Being curious, asking lots of questions, whether that be in a meeting or a discussion as a follow-up, but if there's something you don't understand, go towards it and learn it.
Next up is Tim Richmond, CHRO at Abdi. In episode 113, Raising the Bar on Talent and Culture, Tim talks about what it's like to build a culture from scratch, Abdi's how we work, behaviors, and why it's so important to elevate people leadership in our organizations.
The dream was to be known as a great place to work, to be known as a premier company. That's the fun part for me, is to reflect on all that years later. Now I could tell you all these proof points, all the recognitions we've received, all the positive feedback we have from our employees. But like I said, externally, being named to all these best company and great place to work lists, that validates the work. It validates the strategy. And a lot of it comes back to culture. Our priority around culture was built on something we call the ways we work. I think in every company, probably, JP, you talk to all these other CHROs and all these other people in the HR field, companies have cultures. Now, the best ones have clarity about what their expectations are for culture, like what's the standard. I know other companies don't have that, and I can't imagine how they would operate in that environment. So I would just say, go back to this idea of working for a great company. I'd also want to work for a company that's really clear on expectations around whether it's culture, values, behaviors, whatever it is. And you also want to be something more. Our story is built on something more than the words on the wall. A lot of companies, you walk in the front lobby, the words are on the wall. It's the only place you see them. They're never talked about. They're never reinforced. I took some things, and I think this is what I would say to everyone who's having a chance to listen to this podcast. Take these experiences you have and say, what did good look like? How does it get well executed? And so I want to use an example of making behaviors equal to performance. While we're on a podcast, and people won't be able to see this visually, we created a standard around a high performance orientation, but also a high people leader expectation. We equally value, we equally assess, and this is very important, we equally assess people on their ability to behave against the ways we work. We develop on the ways we work in everything we do. And very importantly, we reward people on the ways we work. So equally reward performance and behaviors. And not many companies do that. I know some people think, God, sounds like a lot of work, and it's not. This is about a strategy around culture that's hardwired, and this is also critical, hardwired into every single HR program, HR process. You cannot avoid it at our company. It's not just the words on the wall. And if I had to walk down the hall and talk to any AbbVie employee, or I was out in the street and met someone to work for AbbVie, and I talked about the ways we work, I expect them to know all five of those ways we work. Part of it's just the expectation. The other part is you're actually paid based on that. So you should know them. You're assessed on, everyone gets feedback at least once a year on their ability to manage the ways we work. What we wanted to create is a standard of people leadership and create layers of leadership built to that standard over time. And now, 11 plus, almost 12 years later, we can say we're well along on that journey. We feel confident in that standard. We think, and our employees validate this, that it's felt around the world. If you're at a manufacturing site, you're an affiliate, the ways you work matters, people leadership matters. And really what it comes down to, if you really want to simplify it for HR people, you're elevating people leader expectations and you're taking out, and this is really important, you're taking out those high performers who do not demonstrate your culture and your behaviors. We have mechanisms to correct that. We have mechanisms to identify that. And really importantly, for those people, we want them to elevate to the standard or they can go work somewhere else. So people leadership is critical at our company, and so is culture.
In episode 111, Investing in and Betting on Talent, Stephanie Lilac, Chief People Officer at Mondelez International, shares how her unique career philosophy and how making unconventional career choices have driven her success. She also, in this clip, talks about what she looks for in an individual when she's investing and betting on them to go further and faster in their career.
One thing that also I think is just so clear, Stephanie, is that you really believe in finding raw talent, investing in developing talent. And how do you know when and why you should invest in someone? What are those signals of high potential talent that you believe someone's worth investing in and stretching? How do you think about that?
Yeah, it's through the lens of I had the incredible benefit of being one of those raw talents that somebody saw and invested in and stretched. I have been stretched my whole life, often by people who believed in me before I believed in myself. That is just, that's the lens I try to put on talent at all times. And I think I see that in talent at all levels in the organization, by the way. I don't just think this is a principle stretching talent, finding talent that just applies at early careers, although I think that is incredibly important and powerful to do. But I think it happens all through a career. What do I look for? There's some innate qualities I think people bring who are differential and who are stretchable. They're usually mature beyond their years. There's just a humbleness, a level of listening, a level of understanding, of appreciation and maturity that an individual brings that you can see in someone. They are people who initiate, they're proactive, and they run to things. They fill gaps. They don't get assigned things. They assign themselves. They're not daunted by big problems. In fact, ooh, you've got a difficult, challenging issue to solve. I'll be there. They're curious. They're learners. And I think they're able to typically synthesize lots of information pretty quickly and get to the essence of things. And again, this can be at any level in the organization. You can see these qualities. They always perform. They always deliver. They're always honest. Values are an aspect of the person. I think that's kind of the mature beyond the years. Like there's deeply held beliefs. There's a basis of values to the individual, and they operate through those values and beliefs. Finally, I have never worked with anybody who is high potential who doesn't partner well, who doesn't do good cross-functional collaboration, who doesn't think about stakeholders and a variety of stakeholders as they're doing work or thinking through decisions or asking for help.
Last but not least is the brilliant and future-focused Prasad Sethi. And in episode 115, Becoming an AI-Powered Company, Prasad not only gives a brief history lesson on people analytics and where it's going, but he also explains how he believes AI will impact jobs and the future of work.
I think in terms of what it does for jobs in the future, there was a research group in the 1960s when it was President Lyndon Johnson out here, and they were looking at automation at that era. They wrote this 300-page research report, and there's one line that really stands out for me. Basically said, automation destroys jobs, but not work. For me, that's perhaps what technology has always been doing in the past few. I don't know exactly what kind of new work will be created, but I do see quite a bit of disruption, and we all need to be prepared for that. Certainly not today or tomorrow, but over the next little while. There are a couple of things in terms of creating new work or making it possible for people to take on new work that I want to just share. One example, JP, is the London Black Caps, right? It takes an immense amount of preparation and studying to become a London Black Cab driver. It's sort of like, on average, it takes someone 4 years or so. You got to memorize 15,000 streets in the middle of London so that you know exactly how to navigate from one place to the other. Even today, there are only 4,000 black cab drivers there who have gone through this really grueling process to get that kind of license. But there are 20,000 Uber drivers in London because all they need to know is how to drive. They don't need to memorize 15,000 streets. They have the Uber and GPS navigation app to help them with that. So I think that's an interesting analogy to think about what Gen AI could provide in terms of capabilities. I think of software engineers, which there are a ton of them in Silicon Valley, but every company you talk to will say there's never enough, right? Because there's always so much more work that we could do if we had amazing software engineers. So what if GenAI could write code, and NVIDIA and Jensen Huang, he already talks about how the future of writing code is going to be in the hands of AI. So therefore, what if people needed to just know what is it that you want to code, or what is it that you think you can solve with software? And that is the people who have experience or education and logic and math and problem solving, but haven't written a line of code. All of those people could be enabled to create software because of GenAI. They sort of become the Uber drivers of software, right? And so you could take that into any field of creation, whether it's writing, whether it's marketing, whether it's graphic design, any one of those areas. And so I do think it will help everyone be much more capable than they are. So that creates work. And you asked about jobs, and this to me is the big unknown in terms of when this will impact society and how we will react to it. Because the impact of having 20,000 Uber drivers and 4,000 London black cab drivers, at least based on the research that they've done so far, is that, of course, people are using ride sharing a lot more. So there are a lot more people who are being driven. If Uber didn't exist, that would have been much lesser. So there's a whole bunch of consumer surplus that has been created, right? Because you now have Uber. But it has dropped the wages of London black cab drivers. The analogy for me would be if everyone becomes capable of writing software, maybe the level of income of software engineers goes down in the long term, but a lot more people are able to write software, and that would benefit folks. I go back and I'll end with sort of relaying back that same line from that automation report from the 60s. Technology might destroy jobs, but not work. I think humans will, with our innate curiosity and our insatiable appetite for new things, we will always create work. How exactly we make them monetarily rewarding, which is like the other component of having a job, that to me is going to be the open question.
Well, that wraps up what was an amazing 2024 for the Future of HR podcast. I'm looking forward to an even better 2025 and continuing my mission to inspire and develop the next generation of leaders one conversation at a time. Thank you all for your support, being part of our community, and we'll talk to you in 2025.